Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Nick Barashev and John Crowley. Nick is president and CEO of BMG, which offers a wide variety of strategies, products, and services for clients looking to integrate bullion into their portfolios. His first book, $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven, is a must-read for investors interested in the concept of sound money. And John is former partner with Ira Harris at Sinclair & Co. back in the 1970s and early 80s. He specialized in precious metals mining shares and wrote the weekly commentary on the shares in the Sinclair & Co. newsletter that had over 25,000 subscribers. Welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a broad macro view of the global economy and the financial markets, and in particular, the precious metals markets. Maybe we can start with Nick, your thoughts.
Well, thank you. I think the two themes that are playing out, they've been theories, but now they're not theories anymore. And that is a combination of stagflation and financial repression. Now, for the moment, gold has been relatively flat because a lot of people are expecting the central banks to raise interest rates. But the issue is they raised interest rates throughout almost all of the 70s, and the gold price went up. So what's key to understand, which ties into financial repression, is that the interest rates are negative. And my view is that they'll stay that way because the Fed can't really do any meaningful raising of interest rates without crashing the stock market and the real estate markets. So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. So they'll just try and use financial repression to quietly get out of the massive debt. Mm-hmm.
And what techniques do you see specifically on financial repression coming?
Well, it is that inflation is rising, the official inflation rate is the highest it's been in 40 years. But if you go to John Williams' shadow stats, he's got inflation running at about 15% based on the 1980s methodology of calculating it. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the main categories, food, gasoline, real estate, et cetera, then it's clearly running much higher than the official rate. But interest rates, for simplicity, let's call them 2%. So the difference between the inflation rate and the interest rate is the nominal rate, and it's negative. And that's a major challenge for retirees, institutions, and the likes, so that they can't make a real return. Mm-hmm. But over time, the government can ease out of the debt by using this methodology.
Yeah, very interesting. And your thoughts, John, on this question for global economy, financial markets, precious metals?
Yes. First of all, I'm glad Nick mentioned someone who I'm an avid reader of also. John Williams' Shadow Stats is, I think, a must read for all of us if we want to get a handle on what's really going on in terms of the real numbers that they're crunching in Washington. I want to build on what he was saying just a moment ago and talk about one of the biggest dangers and the byproduct of artificially low interest rates, or zero interest rate policy, as we call it, and that is the excessive leverage that exists out there right now. We know that the Fed's balance sheet has increased biblically over the last two decades, or actually since the crash of 08. The Fed balance sheet has increased, it's almost quintupled. And what we're also looking at simultaneously, as if we thought we learned something from that particular time, the leverage of the major banks that have survived is only back up to the levels that they were at in 2006, 2007. For instance, Goldman Sachs right now has leveraged their capital to risk is 286%. And JP Morgan is up at 157, and Citibank is at 170. And the top 25 banks all have leverage in excess of 80%. So, and then flip that around, because I think another important item that very few analysts really spend time looking at, and that's the Officer of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC quarterly report. And the amount of derivatives has expanded drastically worldwide. It's currently 211% of global GDP. That's a frightening statistic. And then what we do is we flip over to the stock market, and we look at how the stock market is reflecting all of this leverage. And currently, one of the great measures is that of it's called the Buffett-Munger indicator, and that is the Wilshire 5000 total market cap over GDP. And just recently, not right at this moment, but just a few weeks ago, it hit an all-time record high of 204%. That means that stock market cap is double the amount of income that these companies are capable of producing, in effect. And net-net is that what Nick was just saying a moment ago is correct. The Fed can only tighten so much without undoing the entire system, freezing the entire credit market system. So as the World Gold Council has pointed out not too long ago, is that in the first period after Fed tightening, gold actually performs quite well. People, you've seen some outflows out of gold ETFs and gold investments in the early third quarter of last year. But net-net is that gold tends to do extremely well in early periods of tightening by the Fed. So that coupled with the fact that Indian gold demand is increasing along with Chinese gold demand, the premium on the Shanghai Exchange for physical gold is back up to 7.5%. You want to take physical delivery. Jewelry demand is looking robust again. The fundamental picture for gold is improving. There is a supply overhang right now, but I'll give you a quick photograph. 1968, when everybody was afraid the gold window was going to close and the Swiss were making noises about taking delivery of their gold from the Fed, 5% of all assets under management were in gold-related items. Back then, Americans were not allowed to privately own gold. So they were in numismatic coins and mining shares, a variety of other investments. But overall, globally, 5% of all assets under management were in gold-related items. Today, it's only 0.03%. So imagine just a 0.02% increase. That would wipe out the overall surplus that currently is overhanging the market right now between supply and demand of gold. Mm-hmm. So long term, I think the picture is very, very favorable for gold. And what concerns me is that we didn't learn anything from the 08 crash. We're right back at it again. And the leverage from what I see is far worse than it was before. So any tightening right now is going to have a much, much more pronounced effect on financial assets than it did before.
Right. Yeah, I agree with pretty much all your points. And when you consider the equity markets are, you know, whether you use the Buffett ratio or any of them, we're either at the 1999 highs or the 1929 highs. Right. So it's a historic bubble of unprecedented proportion. It's the longest running bull market in history, and it's well overdue for correction. And when you look at the fact that we've got about $345 trillion in financial assets, stocks and bonds, and only 0.5% in gold, if 5% of those investors were to move into physical gold, that means there would be 17 trillion looking to buy gold. And you couldn't increase mine supply to meet that demand. So the only thing that can adjust is price. And it's with that in mind that you get well over $10,000 an ounce on just a 5% movement. So that's a bad matter of time when that comes in. Now, and many investors seem frustrated with gold that hasn't done much and so on, but in reality, gold has averaged 10% annual increases in virtually all the currencies since the year 2000. Now, most institutions like pension funds, they target for 6, and many of them don't get that. And other than 4 pension funds, none of the institutions own any gold. So the thing that they, you know, seems to be missing in the institutional level and many investors is that you can do the math 10 ways to Sunday, but if you add gold to a portfolio, it improves the returns of the portfolio and reduces the risk. So it's just a question of time before that trend, you know, kicks in.
What do you think has been the stumbling block for that to happen? Like, what is preventing pension funds, insurance companies to put some significant investment?
Well, I think it's, you know, all the psychological barriers of complacency, normalcy, bias, that type of thing. This is what they've been doing for the last 20 years, some degree of success. And it's very hard for people generally to adapt to a paradigm shift in any way. They don't adapt to that readily. Ray Dalio has written extensively about how we're in the midst of a paradigm shift, and the next 20 years will be mere opposite of the last 20 years. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. And your thoughts, John?
I think what we're doing is we're really complementing each other here, because we see the same problems existing in the international credit markets, which basically feed into the equities markets. And that is that here in the United States, you've had a zero interest rate policy now for almost, well, over 15 years. And here's what the Fed is doing. They're basically taking the taxpayers' money and they're handing it over to the banks, the only few banks that are left after the crash. And what you have is, you have, for instance, Goldman Sachs taking all of their securities and going to the discount window and getting 100% of the value, the market value of those shares in return to go ahead and do what the Fed tells them to do. Just keep buying stocks. Don't worry, because we'll backstop you. Anytime the market has a sharp down day, at 3:40, when they publish all the order imbalances on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the Fed steps in. And if the market's down sharply, they start buying stocks just in mass at the Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan trading desks to prop the markets up. So in effect, what they're really saying is that, don't worry, if you screw up, we've got you covered. We'll take care of, we'll clean up your mess. Just keep going to the discount window, just keep borrowing money and just keep buying stocks, and we'll take care of you. But ultimately, this is going to backfire. And in abbreviated form, Nick pointed out the amount of money overall invested globally in equities and bonds. The problem is the exits aren't big enough. And the specialists on the floor have been through this before. Black Monday was the first time it happened, where they just stopped answering their phones, even though legally they were required to, because they couldn't get short because of all these program trades who didn't have to follow the zero plus tick rule. And you had all this other shadow trading, and these guys could not get out ahead of this thing. And so they just stopped answering their telephones because they knew it was on the other end of it, sell orders, which they couldn't accommodate. And you'll see the same thing again, especially when you have all of this electronic trading now taking over most of the volume. there's nobody monitoring what a market maker is doing. If you work on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and you're a specialist, you are required to make an orderly market in return for having the book to see what both buy and sell orders are. So if you're trading on a computer, how do they monitor you when you say, oh, I was in the bathroom when that sell order came across? There's no way of doing it. So you're going to see these huge air pockets in markets over time. And proof of that is that as of recently, the amount of, or kurtosis, the fat tails in the bell curve of all the events in the stock market have gotten fatter and are becoming more and more frequent. So the volatility has increased, and any old timer knows that markets are poor volatility, and that's what the markets are subject to day in and day out now.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's the problem. To understand this, you have to be an old timer like us.
Right. One of the advantages is getting old.
The other thing that makes this, you know, ties both of these themes together is the margin debt, and it's increased by over 200% since the 2008 crash. So when this market turns and the margin calls get made, it'll exacerbate the downward draft to a point possibly where the Fed won't be able to step in fast enough.
Mm-hmm. And John,
there was an interview that I watched Jim Grant do on 60 Minutes. No, it was on C-SPAN. And the interviewer was kind of naive about how the Fed operates. And he looked at Jim Grant. And he said, "Do you mean to tell me that the Fed can create $1 billion in like that?" And he just smiled at the interviewer and said, "Faster than Alexa."
Well, that's gets to the root of everything that people never knew what it was like to be on the gold standard and how stable things were, and don't really understand money creation. And to most people, they wouldn't believe that the Fed has the ability to create an unlimited amount of currency with no restraints whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And that gets to the question on the millennial generation. Do you see them as being unaware of the potential for precious metals? Like a lot of them are piling into these cryptocurrencies. What are your thoughts on that, Nick?
Well, in theory, cryptocurrencies can be better than pure fiat money. But the first thing is you have to add up all the fiat currencies. You can't just limit it to Bitcoin and say that there's a restraint. When you take them all into account, there isn't a restraint. So there's just as much cryptocurrency being created as a total as the Fed's creating US dollars. The second thing is that you have stable coins, but stable coins have no regulation whatsoever. The US is looking into regulating them like a bank, so they'll need audited statements and so on and so forth, none of which they have now. But the real issue is that the Western governments are creating their own government-created cryptocurrencies. And China has already banned cryptocurrencies. Russia's in the process. And when they create their own cryptocurrency, they'll make it very unattractive for the privately run cryptos. If you had a monopoly to create money out of thin air, why are you going to put up with any competition? Right. So one way or another, they'll be taxed into oblivion or regulated out of existence. Right. And what they've done in the past, in some cases of digital currency, is they either set you up with some bad players or you started, because of the anonymity of it, you're inevitably going to have money launderers, pornographers, and drug dealers. So at some point in time, they, you know, you get raided and everybody gets arrested. Now it's harder to find who to arrest in cryptocurrencies, but yeah, you can deal with the people that are using it. You know.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, John?
I heard Warren Buffett bring up a very valid point that it has always been in the back of my mind when it comes to cryptocurrencies, and that is, why would I want to own something whose value hinges on what the next guy's willing to pay for it? Nick, you can attest to this more than anybody else. That somebody walks into your shop, buys a bar of gold, they're gonna see a known hallmark stamp on the bar itself, and you're gonna give them a statement of assay to go along with it. So you're verifying that it's at least three nines, maybe four nines, fine.
Right.
And with that, you could take that bar of gold anywhere, and there's absolutely no counterparty risk at the end of it. And more importantly, it's universally accepted as store value.
Well, exactly, and it's solid. And that's what I think we're gonna transition into, where, you know, physical assets, whether it's gold or real estate or even, you know, art, where you have something tangible backing the value, rather than just, you know, a price based on the sort of the greater fool theory, who's willing to pay you more than what it costs you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned
that's where they talk about, like with gold and silver, is the fact that you've got a floor to the value, which is the cost of production.
Absolutely.
And that we're in an area where production is scheduled to decrease. There hasn't been any significant, you know, discoveries, big discoveries, so on. And it's actually worse than silver, because silver, it is got both a supply and demand problem. On the supply side, 80% of silver supply is byproduct. And on the demand side, when it's used in electronics, there first of all isn't any other choice. And the price of silver to the end product is insignificant. So like in an iPhone, you may have a 50 cents worth of silver, can't use anything else. And it doesn't make any difference to the price of the iPhone, whether silver is 20 bucks or 200 bucks. So that's a very unusual anomaly. So as the price of silver rises, the demand can't, or sorry, the supply can't rise up to keep the price suppressed.
Very interesting. And what about in terms of, you mentioned stable coins earlier, Nick, like the idea of having a silver-backed or a gold-backed cryptocurrency, like one token per 1 ounce of silver. What do you make of that, given the trend of a lot of movement towards central bank digital currencies and blockchain? Would that not make sense?
Well again, the transparency on that and the third party verification, it's one thing to say you've got the coins, but it's another thing, like we go through a great deal of trouble for high net worth investors that buy physical bars from us and they're stored at Brinks. It's quite a process, because to own a gold bar, you have to have a title document that has the refiner, the serial number, the exact weight, and the exact purity to identify which bar is yours. So for example, in our funds, we have to pay a storage fee to a custodian. If we bought unallocated gold or certificates, there would be no storage fee. We'd have to pay anything. But then I don't own the gold. The investors don't own the gold. and that defeats the primary reason to own it. You actually have to own it. So the stable coins would be a good idea if the transparency was there to verify that they in fact have allocated bullion backing the thing.
Your thoughts, John, on the stable coins?
Well, yeah, I mean, the another way of looking at it is simply asking, why don't the central banks simply go back to the gold standard? Because it's really this, you're bringing up the same problem. You need transparency, you need regulation. And I don't think any of the regulators, or more importantly, their bosses, the politicians, want to be tethered to this. They want the freedom, as one commentator once said, no politician ever lost a vote by electing to print money.
That's right, exactly.
And I think they lose a lot of their freedom if they adhere to these disciplines. They can't get away with a lot of the shenanigans that they've been up to as of late.
Exactly. So until there's some kind of a major restructuring or a crash, that they're not going to go along with any kind of a voluntary reset in terms of the financial system.
They have to be dragged in kicking and screaming, and they have to form all these committees and hearings, and how could this have happened? And yeah, it's all paraded on CNN and live television, and it's all bad kabuki, basically.
That's right, exactly right.
And yeah, so we've talked about a lot on gold and silver. What about the other precious metals like platinum, palladium, and even rhodium? Your thoughts, Nick?
Well, these are like the, when you look at all the precious metals, gold is primarily a monetary asset with secondary commodity applications. Silver is sort of 50-50 monetary and commodity. Then the rest, platinum, rhodium, et cetera, are primarily commodities. So then it's a supply-demand thing. But for example, in platinum, you have the same situation as silver, because if you have a diesel truck that's worth $150,000, you might have $50 of platinum in it, but you can't make any diesel trucks without the platinum. And in the case of diesel, you can't replace it with palladium. So in all cases, you've got a commodity that's not replaceable by a cheaper commodity. You have to use it, and it's insignificant to the end price of the product.
I have something to add to that. I don't know if you, Nick, I don't know if you recall, but back in the, when was it? It was the early 80s that Jim Sinclair, my partner, spearheaded this new investment fund to invest in, quote, strategic metals. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you recall, and it got a lot of interest before the fund lifted off the ground. And I was sent over to London for about 3 months to do a lot of research on these particular metals, because that was the major trading center for all of them, including platinum, rhodium, and these are all precious metals that were used for industrial purposes. And one of the things that I found was the key point that you're bringing up, plus the other issue, was that this market was basically a closed shop. It was between the producers and the wholesale suppliers, the refiners of these metals. And the public had no business getting in the middle. And the problem with platinum, the perfect example, is that, yes, platinum is a very, very tight market relative to gold and silver. But the problem is it's a double-edged sword. It works the other way. All of a sudden, a huge supply of platinum has to show up on the market, and the price comes crashing down relative to gold and silver. So that's the reason why I came back after the firm spent all this money sending me to London, flying me over there on Concord, all this other nonsense. And I come back, and Jim asked me to do a write-up on my findings. And I said, I can tell you right now in just a couple of sentences. And he said, what? And here he was. He went through all the regulatory approval issues and all the expense. And I said, I said to him, very simple, one sentence, not for the public. And he went berserk. I almost got fired. that was the case. The only place where there was any wiggle room for the public and institutions to get involved on an investment basis was by buying the companies that mine this stuff. And they were minority, or they were minority companies inside a bigger mining company. So it was a very diluted play. And at the end of the day, the public had no business being in it.
Well, there's one factor that particularly applies to the rare metals, and that is that if you're a manufacturer that requires it, buying futures doesn't help you.
Right.
Because you need the actual metal. And we've had a small taste of what that means in the microchip market. Like, you don't have the microchips, you don't build the end product for a relatively small part. So at some point in time, whether it's an Elon Musk or whatever, because it happened in 1998 when Ford bought, I think it was $5 billion of palladium and took physical delivery, because without palladium that was needed for gasoline catalytic converters, you don't make any cars. And it doesn't do you any good buying paper futures of palladium. You still can't make any cars.
Right.
So at some point in time, that realization is going to register on the big users of it. And they'll buy huge amounts just to stay in business.
Right.
So in terms of the evolution, as you talked earlier, Nick, on the cryptocurrencies, if we get this increasingly regulated market or outlawed altogether, do you see some of the assets currently in the cryptocurrency market going into gold and silver?
Well, that's one attempt. I mean, you can have stable coins backed by real estate, by, you know, food, by whatever. So as long as it's regulated and the collateral backing is in fact there, then that's one thing. But whether it is right now or not, we'll see how the implosion of Evergrande will ultimately, they could affect the number of stable coins that then move up and affect the likes of the Bitcoins. So just that one kind of move. Mm-hmm. Well, what worries me the most about the cryptocurrency and everything is that the agenda that many of the politicians and governments seem to have is, you introduce vaccine passports, then you have to have one, you have to get vaccinated, you have to have all your medical records on it, you have to have all your financial records on it. Like, it'll keep expanding. And then if they create a government-backed cryptocurrency, it'll be on that vaccine passport. So then they have total control. Like, if you wander too far away from your house, they can cut you off. You can't buy anything. Your car will stop. So that's a very dangerous development to look at it, but that's what they're trying to implement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And your thoughts, John?
On the subject of cryptocurrencies, the real issue here, I think I want to go back to what Nick was talking about very briefly. It's something I always bring up when I talk about the difference between the two types of investments. I see gold as being a finite precious metal asset, store of money, store of value. And the reason for that is something Nick mentioned very briefly that I keep going over time and time again, and that is there have been no significant gold deposit finds in the last three decades. The last two major gold deposits were discovered in the late 90s. And since then, with all the new technology available, they've not been able to find anything. So gold, in my mind, is a relatively finite asset. My biggest concern, I've talked to a couple of hedge fund managers about this. My concern down the road is that if there seems to be some consensus that everybody should have a little bit of gold in their portfolio, the day is coming where you're going to have bids, but no offers. I mean, you can't afford to be short gold. If you are, or you don't have it, you're just not going to be able to buy it. It's just not going to be there.
Well, in some European countries already, the number of coins that an individual can buy is limited. So they're already having to tighten it up. And eventually that'll be a problem for any major buyer to buy a lot. When we're dealing with pension funds and so on, we keep saying, look, you can't just wait around till it becomes obvious to everybody that this is happening, because by that time, the amount of gold like an institution needs, you won't be able to buy for a reasonable price. And the more you try and buy it, the higher the price will rise. The other thing that I always say that hasn't fully played out is China's gold. So the Central Bank of China purports to have 1,500 tons, and their stated objective is to have 10,000 tons, which would put them above the U.S. But the thing is, many analysts have already determined that they have north of 5,000 tons, and they buy that in the sovereign wealth fund, and they can move it from the sovereign wealth fund to the central bank anytime they feel like it. But in the meantime, the sovereign wealth fund doesn't report anything to anybody. But the question will become, if they ever turns out that that's true, and they do move, say, 5,000 tons from the sovereign wealth fund to the central bank, the question is going to be, where did they get that 5,000 tons from? Because if you look at GFMS and CPM, which are the reporting services, they've accounted everything right down to the fraction of an ounce. So the only place this could come from is leased gold that the authorized participants, you know, redeem from the ETFs and then sell the gold to China rather than paying it back to the central bank. So when this happens, it'll become obvious to everybody that the Western central banks are just holding a bunch of paper IOUs from the bullion banks, and that they have a lot less gold than they purport to have. And China has all the gold, and the gold isn't coming back.
There's a very interesting series of videos. You may have heard of, do you know who Grant Williams is? Have you heard of
Grant Williams? Yeah.
I saw an interesting one, one of his videos. I recommend him to everybody. I saw the video about a year ago. And he showed all of the data relative to all of the major storage facilities in Rotterdam, Zurich, Geneva, New York, and in London. And basically, in a nutshell, it appears as if all the Western gold vaults are being empty. Mm-hmm. And another thing, and the question is, well, where is all this gold going? And according to the vaults, they're being sent eastward to India and to China. And the other thing that I find interesting is that the two major gold depositories in the United States, of course, are Fort Knox. And the other one is just down the road from here, a couple of miles in West Point. The balance sheet of West Point has changed the classification of their gold holdings. And as an accountant, the only knowing GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles down here, the only reason for doing that is if there is some type of encumbrance on that particular item on the balance sheet. So I'm just saying to myself, either somebody is claiming that they own this, or that there is some type of transaction that's occurred that in the future is being sent to a prospective buyer. So I'm thinking that on top of what you're pointing out, which is valid, you have that plus the fact that we know that the vaults in the West are being emptied as we speak.
Right. Well, when I started BMG, one of the first books I read was Frank Van Russo's book, The Gold Book.
Right.
And it was probably the most expensive book I've ever bought. It was $900 at the time. But he detailed in great detail the amount of outstanding gold leases at the central banks. And then a couple of years later, he updated it. And from what I remember, the update was that there was 16,000 tons of leased gold outstanding out of the 32,000 tons. And this is you know, really bizarre kind of rule that a central bank can lease its gold to a bullion bank. The bullion bank then does whatever they want with the gold. And the central bank on its balance sheet still shows that it owns the gold.
Right.
Which it does, because a lessor retains title to the asset. But if the asset is in China and it's not coming back, it's a moot point.
Exactly. It's simply a piece of paper, nothing more. Good luck defending it.
Yeah, but then you see the implications of that is, if this does ever play out, what does that do to the dollar?
Yeah.
And many of the other Western currencies when it becomes obvious that there is no gold backing whatsoever.
Right, right, right.
Just like Canada.
Yep. Yeah. Sold all its gold. This is another point that I wanted to touch upon. And that is that I have been saying this for some time now, but I think we're closer to it than ever. I say de facto, it's already happened, but de jure, I mean, per law, per the Bretton Woods Agreement, I think it's maybe 4 to 8 years away. And that is the United States dollar losing its reserve currency status.
That's right. Well, it's well past due the length of time, you know, for reserve currencies to have survived. So it's already past due for that. But if it loses its reserve currency status, then the U.S. becomes a third world country overnight.
Exactly. And if this happens, then there has to be a very brilliant hedge fund manager who's passed on. Suggested this to me. He said, by the time that happens, he says the United States government and maybe some of the other Western governments as well, but particularly the U.S. government, because we've toyed with this before, will impose very strict exchange control rules here in this country that'll really limit the amount of capital that can flow out of the United States.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll have no other choice.
And just to finish up a last question, your potential price targets, if you have any for gold and silver through the rest of this year and into next year, Nick?
Well, the question is if the markets move somewhat normally, just continuation on the theme, then we'll probably get over $2,000. But if there's a mother of all market crashes, and the thing is, when the equity markets crash, so will the real estate markets. And if that happens, then the sky's the limit in terms of, because then, like I say, that some portion of the $348 trillion is going to panic and try and buy gold. So that's when you get an unlimited, price rise. And when you look at real estate, which will be affected the same way, it's also in a bubble. It's Case-Shiller real estate index is the same as it was at the peak of 2007. So it's also due for a correction. So these are just the things. And Unlike the 70s, where we had a stagflation, we've got a much bigger problem because we've got rising inflation, rising debt, and a supply chain problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody willing to go to work. Things aren't getting made. So effect on GDP is worse.
Yeah. Very interesting. And John?
My turn. I feel like we're in one of those HGTV house shows where you have to guess the price of the house after you look at it. I think what I'll do is I'll refer to a very dear late friend of mine who maybe you folks know, especially being up in Toronto. I used to be very good friends with Ian McAvity, who wrote Deliberations.
Right.
Ian piggybacked a study back about, oh God, it was about 8 or 9 years ago. He did in one of his newsletters. And this individual actually presented the case, and it made a lot of sense then. I mean, you know, now things have changed quite a bit, but he suggested back then, in around 2013-14, that in order to create dishoarding in gold, you'd have to see the price get up to about $6,600 an ounce. And of course, if that case was valid then, what does it have to go to now? We could be talking $8,000-$10,000 an ounce, but God forbid if it ever happened.
Well, when I wrote my book 5 years ago, $10,000 gold, I was like a lone wolf in the wilderness,
and right,
people thought I was crazy and everything. But now, Jim Rickards, everybody, number of people have come up with estimates well in excess of 10,000, like 40,000 ounce. At the Rickards matches it to the money supply. So, how much coverage do you want to have for the money supply and so on? So we get into very high numbers, and although these seem hard to imagine, but when you consider that in the German inflation, gold was 75 marks an ounce when it started, and a few years later it was 23 trillion marks an ounce. So you get into a hyperinflation, you get bizarre numbers.
Well, it's been an awesome, insightful discussion. Gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work? Nick?
Well, they can go to our website. We have two websites, BMG Group, which is for our three mutual funds and the bullion bars. And then we have another site called BMG DIY Investor. So this is for investors that do their own investing. So it's kind of an information portal of all the aspects of investing that they mm-hmm. need to know to make a wise decision themselves.
Great, and John?
Well, I'm retired, but I, as you know, I work very closely with Ira, and I love being on these things, exchanging ideas with some very knowledgeable people like Nick. And I think someone like Nick is the type of person that somebody with a substantial amount of assets who are looking to protect their wealth need to go sit down and talk to, because Nick is obviously very knowledgeable, very cool, calm, collected, and approaches the thing as if gold is what I profess it is. And it's an insurance policy, something very similar to what you buy every month on your automobile and your home. And you just dollar average. I've learned over time that trying to time the gold market is a fool's errand. It's very difficult to do. So the next best thing to do is dollar average. And that is just take the same dollar amount every month around the same day and buy whatever amount of gold that the market authorizes you to buy. When it's up, you buy less. When it's down, you buy more. And that's really what you want to do, is create a solid, stable core position.
That's right. Yeah, we've looked at all the technical analysis, and we found we haven't come one that actually works here. You know, it's like throwing darts at a dartboard.
Right.
There's no consistency. That technical analysis seems to work on a broad-based, diversified thing like the S&P 500, but it doesn't work for a manipulated asset like gold, because the analysts at the Fed are looking at technical analysis and then they move the markets whatever way they want at the time. So it's pretty useless in my view. What we did find though is like I've gone out of mining stocks personally. I did invest in them in the beginning and I intend to invest again, but given that we've got a pending market crash, if we have a broad-based equity decline, the mining stocks have tended to decline by more. And that's simply because they're so thinly traded compared to the regular equities and tech stocks. But then if you sit it out in bullion for the time being, and when the market crashes, then you're going to be able to buy, you know, mining stocks for major discounts,
right?
By, you know, Amazon and Google then at major discounts and so on. So right. For the fact that you sit it out for whatever length of time remains before the market crash, the payoff could be huge when you have the investment. I always look at real estate because of my background. An example I use is the Dundee Dream Office REIT, which is a $12 billion REIT in Canada with all the AAA office buildings. In 2008, it declined 84%, but the dividend yield at the bottom was 20.
Oh.
And it's simply because while the stock price of the REIT declined, the rents didn't change. Everybody was paying the same rent at the top and at the bottom. So you've got this anomaly where you've got a huge thing, but you had to be out of the market either in cash or preferably bullion to take up that kind of opportunity.
Correct.
And that's what we have now. We have huge opportunities if we have the patience and self-discipline to wait for the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Nick, you brought up a very interesting point about the mining shares, which is really where I cut my teeth back in the 70s in the gold market before we could own it down here legally in 1975. And back in the day, analyzing and managing a portfolio of gold mining stocks was very, very simple. But after the dot-com bust, the thing that I noticed is that the mining companies as a group, especially the more established ones, got into the business of trying to attract the eyeballs and money of the major international investment funds. And they started trying to compete with the tech sector and the biotech sector and some of the other sectors out there that fund of funds were just throwing money at. And what happened, in order to attract these dollars or this money, they had to show blowout earnings each quarter. They had to compete on a quarter-to-quarter basis for all these other companies. The way they did that was they did what I call high grading, where they went to the higher grade sections of the mines and they extracted that gold because the profit margins were going to be astronomical. And now what they're left with are mines that are depleted in terms of overall reserves and far more costlier to get those reserves out of the ground. So I think that in a general sense, I think the entire mining share strategy, the model's broken. And I don't know if it's ever going to be corrected again, given the finite amount of gold that we know exists.
Well, that's where, like I say, you need two conditions, in my view, is one for the broad equity markets to finish their correction, and two, then you have to be very careful selecting and evaluating each mining company.
Absolutely.
In terms of what they have and where their, you know, reserves are and all the rest of it. But that's why I say that the big opportunity will come at the bottom. For those patient enough to wait and sit it out in the meantime.
Agreed. Yeah.
Great words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Nick and John. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Rick. I really enjoyed it. A lot of fun. Nick, I appreciate spending some time with you. I learned quite a bit from you.
Oh, yeah. No, me too. So, thank you. Good talking to you.
You too. See you soon. Take care.
I know. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.